Well, they moved from the Communist Party, COINTELPRO, the incept date of which is 1956, to 1960, they take on the SWP as well. Now, that's that little Trotskyite organization, doing pretty much the same thing that they had done with the Communist Party. Communist Party ends up being 50% agent personnel. The SWP ends up being 30% agent personnel. And then they take on the Puerto Rican independence movement. They never really declare an incept date for that, but that's in 1960 as well. And you start to have these overlaps with the civil rights movement that's emerging in the South, SCLC, NAACP, and so forth, Robert Williams. And in particular, because initially the SWP is trying to collaborate, provide support to Williams' wing of the NAACP. They decide it's all a communist plot. Wouldn't have been too difficult for J. Edgar Hoover to arrive at this particular position. He's been FBI director since 1924. Okay, he's a rabid anti-communist and he's a rabid racist, refers to Martin Luther King as being Burrhead. The Burrhead is the FBI code name for Martin Luther King. So the racial content and the sensibilities of the people who are doing this sort of thing really tend to speak for themselves. There is never a formal COINTELPRO declared against SCLC, although they engage in all of the activities of counterintelligence that they're developing with the CP and the SWP. Okay? There is no COINTELPRO under that nomenclature declared against the offshoots and the people who disagree, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Corps and so forth. You've got disagreements. There's not a homogeneous block of organizations out there who are composed of different age groups or religious sensibilities that comprise the civil rights movement. They take them all under fire in various ways, okay? But they never declare under that cryptonym, which simply means counterintelligence program directed at domestic targets. They never really open case files on them under that particular rubric, but you find all the operational techniques in the files of what it is that they do. What they, on the other hand, declare is a COINTELPRO against what they call white racist hate, white racist hate groups. There is a counterintelligence operation aimed at them. But you got to make a juxtaposition in order to understand how they work there. They will infiltrate. They will do the same things that they will do to us, to right-wingers or racists, in a whole lot of ways. But the intent was different. The outcome, what they intended to accomplish by it. What they were after with the CP was a laboratory experiment. What they were after was the SWP was to destroy the organization. What they're after, even though they're not declaring it a counterintelligence program per se, with regard to the various elements of the civil rights movement, is to destroy the organization. What they're after when they declare an open COINTELPRO in their internal documents with the Klan is to take over the Klan and use it as an instrumentality in the furtherance of their counterintelligence objectives to the other organizations. Now, here's how this works. The Klan, actually, in some of its dimensions in the South, there's always been a relationship with the government. In fact, the Klan has been the government in a number of instances in American history. It ran Indiana in the 1920s, for example. It ran Colorado in the 1920s. It ran New Jersey. This is not a Southern phenomenon specifically, although it has strength in the South. It's actually had more political success in the North than it has in the South. But in any event, you've got this clear interlock between Klan interests and government interests that runs like a current through 20th century American history. But you actually got some wild card players out there, particularly in Mississippi, with something called the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And they're not really coordinating what they're doing with the federal government. And it becomes ultimately embarrassing. They kill the three civil rights workers that everybody knows about. They killed 30 civil rights workers. That means 27 of them are people you've never heard of. Three of them got famous. Why? Because two of them were well-connected Jewish boys from New York City, major Democratic funders, which meant that their families were connected to the coordinator of Democratic politics for the state of New York. And when Mickey Schwerner disappeared, the guy got on the phone to Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the president of the United States, said, "This is absolutely unacceptable. What are you going to do about it?" And what he did about it was give J. Edgar Hoover an ultimatum to resolve a murder case for the first time with regard to the repression of civil rights workers by the Klan, or he was going to send the Navy in to do it, which would have been embarrassing to Hoover. And so Hoover actually assigned a bunch of agent personnel. top dog, top counterintelligence program personnel. William Sullivan ran the operation himself. That's the associate director of the FBI in charge of this sort of thing. And they went in about 3 weeks, fixed that problem. They didn't fix it the way you saw in Mississippi burning, through superior investigative work and all of that. They went in and they hired a Klansman and said, A, we will not prosecute you for complicity in the murder, and B, we'll pay you $30,000. All you got to do is first tell us where the bodies are, and then give us the evidence as to who did it so that we can have a successful conclusion to the case. So is your tax dollars at work? That's how long it took them, however. At any moment in that whole process of violence in the civil rights movement, the FBI could have rolled up the Klan like, I don't know, somebody's used toilet paper, I suppose. They had the option, and they proved it right there. But it goes beyond that. In his memoir, Sullivan says, by the fall of 64, this is 3 months after the Myburn killings occurred, we had control of the Mississippi Klan. The White Knights were under our control. We had 20% or more of their membership, including the top leadership positions. We ran the thing from there on. Okay? Now, you can almost see him beating his chest at how well they'd done, how effective his methods were. But 50 pages on in the book, he makes mention of between 1964 and 1969, there's 300-odd bombings by the Mississippi Klan in Mississippi. Now, if the FBI is 20% or more of the membership and they have all the top slots, who is it that did those 300 bombings, and who was it that got bombed? And why didn't you hear about it? Because it wasn't a wild card operation. It was a federal operation. It was an FBI operation. The guy who ran the operation said so. If you actually read what it was that he said, take those two pieces and put them together. Okay, and they were hitting the right targets. And what were the right targets? The targets were things that were fundamental to the civil rights movement, to the furtherance of black interests in the South. They were using the Klan. Their counterintelligence operation had been to take over the Klan, to use it as an instrumentality to repress the civil rights movement. We need to understand that as well. Black Panther Party, they do declare COINTELPRO. Black Panther Party is a very, how should we put it, very committed, very dedicated, very undeterrable organization. It picks up on a lot of the Garveyan ideas. What is the Black Panther Party about? The Black Panther Party is about essentially black communities seceding from the order of things and establishing a self-sufficiency base of their own, so they can be in control of their own destiny. And that's why they're targeted. J. Edgar Hoover actually writes a memorandum in 1968 saying the most dangerous organization in the country, he's already said this at a press club conference, the most dangerous organization, the greatest threat to internal security of the United States is the Black Panther Party, which then numbers 500 people. Okay? Why? Well, he makes that clear in a subsequent memo. Because they're doing things like running a Breakfast for Children program, and he actually targets the feeding of school children before they go to school in the morning so that they'll have nutrient content, protein, and so forth, so they can do little things like think when they're in class, okay, as being a subversive activity, and makes it a number one priority target for elimination. Why? Because it self-sufficiency, self-determination comes from self-sufficiency, and that disrupts the smooth ordering of things. Yeah, the Panther idea was an idea that would resonate with those 500 people were resonating with, by poll at the time, 100,000 people in the black community. And that's what it was that was dangerous. It wasn't that they were killing cops. That was the packaging. And that's another end of the counterintelligence operation, is the packaging. There's a continuum of operational techniques. And it begins with disinformation, and that has to do with the packaging. And anybody that reads anything about the Black Panther Party at the time, contemporaneous stuff, or most of the post hoc historical assessments will find the word violence associated with them. The violence-prone Black Panthers, who are getting shot to pieces for serving eggs to kids in the morning, for running community health clinics, for trying to do job placement services, for rehabilitating slum buildings, for trying to make slumlords accountable to the people who are enriching them, and so on and so on and so on, trying to really constructively transform the fabric of their community existence, are targeted as being violent or violence prone. And why? because they exercised their constitutional right to defend themselves by arms if they were attacked by arms by the people who were in fact attacking them by arms. Between 1967 and 1971, 28 members of the Black Panther Party were killed by police and affiliated agencies. There's not one dead cop that you can hang your hat on. The one conviction was Huey Newton, which was a manslaughter conviction, and that was overturned in court. There is not one dead cop, 28 dead Panthers, and I have never seen a description of the violence-prone police agencies that were repressing the Black Panther Party under coordination of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You got to understand. That the demonization, the packaging of organizations so that they will be repellent rather than attractive to the general sensibility of the American public is the first level of counterintelligence neutralization. The FBI has an entire stable, still to this day. They don't call it that anymore. You don't hear about it because it became embarrassing to hear about that. Information leaked out. They have what they call friendly or cooperating journalists. That means they'll write whatever the FBI tells them to write. In a lot of cases, they don't even write it. They have what they call a crime statistics division in the basement of the building. Those guys aren't dealing with crime statistics in any way at all. They're writing copy. And what you got is journalists out there with the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Washington Times and all the rest of these, LA Tribune and so forth, who habitually sign off copy that was written in the basement of the FBI building, put it out to you as news. Small wonder you're getting one point of view as a consensus viewpoint in the American media. That's good business, and they don't get attacked as a result. And they don't even have to work for a living. They just can go down to Joe Cocker's bar, okay, and watch C-SPAN, I suppose, ESPN, whatever it is they do, and get paid for it. And you get their copy, their byline, they get the awards. That's the first level. Second level is this infiltration, provocateur stuff, so that you're spreading disinformation person to person within the organization themselves in order to disrupt. If they can badjack at you, if they can get you discredited among your peers and neutralize your political effectiveness, if you are assessed by them as having some potential, they'll try to take you out that way. If they can't discredit you individually or organizationally in the media, they'll try to do it that way or some combination of the two. If that doesn't work, well, we got other techniques. Some of the techniques would include the creation of pseudo-gangs. That's the technique they picked up from a couple of British counterinsurgency, not counterintelligence, but counterinsurgency specialists by the name of Robin Evely and Frank Kitson. Okay? A pseudo gang, well, that's an interesting use. I said they always call us gangs. It's basically to create a political organization out of whole cloth in order to foment an ideological dispute where none otherwise existed. And you got some classic examples of that. You got the most classic of all probably being Lyndon LaRouche having the National Council of Labor Caucuses back at the inception of the 70s announced itself as being the hegemonic force of the left and proceeded to go around and trash everybody else's meetings by throwing bricks at their heads. Turns out to have been a government operation the whole time. LaRouche at that time was a paid federal employee. Okay, so you get an inside organization, you get an outside organization, you also have actual ideological disputes between bona fide organizations, exacerbate these using infiltrators, using disinformation. And I got a classic case in Southern California between the United Slaves and the Black Panther Party where the FBI sat down with a cartoon kit and released cartoons on behalf of both organizations defaming the leadership of the other. So they copied. For the Black Panther Party, they copied the style of Emory Douglas, who was the house artist of the Black Panther Party, who was a minister of culture, did the cartoons. You can find the back page of the Black Panther newspaper. They had an FBI artist sitting there copying his style, putting out things, calling Ron Coringa, the head of the United Slaves, a pork chop nigger, insulting and degrading, knowing full well this is a very volatile situation. And in the assessment of the FBI, as they put it, extremely violence-prone organizations. They wanted to foment the animosity between the two groups and then, quote, let nature take its course. Nature took its course, ultimately, with a little more help from the FBI, with two infiltrators walking in to Campbell Hall in the UCLA campus on January 17th, 1969, and putting .357 caliber Magnum bullets in the heads of John Huggins and Bunchy Carter, who were the two primary leaders of the L.A. chapter of the Black Panther Party at the time. Okay, the shooter is a guy who's never been apprehended, and he was support cast with a couple guys by the name of Steiner, all on the FBI payroll. The Steiners were actually apprehended, convicted, and walked out of a maximum security prison as escapees in California 3 years after the fact. Okay? They took credit for that in the internal memoranda as a successful operation. Huggins and Carter are dead. No FBI guy or no one attributable to the FBI actually pulled the trigger. But they created the circumstance, or so they said, and that's a believable thing, said it works so well, we recommend we continue the operation. 2 months later, Sylvester Bell gets killed in San Diego. Same thing. The intelligence counterintelligence operative in the LA office who orchestrated the cartoon campaign said, look, it worked again. There's all kinds of dis-ease, potential violence in the black community all throughout Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego, everywhere. And while we cannot take sole credit for this, it is attributable in large part to our counterintelligence initiatives. We recommend it be continued. Ultimately, in New Jersey, they're putting out a scorecard to try to antagonize membership of United Slaves there and get them into, quote, a shooting war with the Black Panther Party in the Northeast. It says, Panthers, zip, us, six. So basically what they're doing there is taking credit for six of the dead Panthers that are not attributable to police causes at the time. A body count, and that's the indicator of a successful operation. So pseudo-gangs and the exacerbation of intergroup tensions. And there's a number of other examples of a similar sort that I could run down. That's the next level. Beyond that, you involve the friendly local police departments for pretext arrest. Philadelphia, 1967, you got a very long report after a summer's repression of the Revolutionary Action Movement that said basically we've had the local police work in cooperation with the local police to have them arrest these guys time after time after time on any pretext. We're not looking for convictions. We're looking for arrests. If we can force them into an arrest situation, then we're tying them up in jail until they can make bail. When they make bail, they're having to expend resources they would use for other activities and put themselves back in the street. And guess what? When they walk out the front door of the police station, we arrest them again for spitting on the sidewalk and put them right back in the cell. We've had situations where after about six or seven rounds of this, we've got veteran organizers who are laying on the floor in their living rooms and they're being arrested for the ninth time, crying and kicking the floor. They're so frustrated as they're being hauled away again. We got a guy who got his parole revoked for possession of a deadly weapon. Turns out to be a 3/4-inch blade penknife. This is pretext stuff. It has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has everything to do with neutralizing people they've identified as being, quote, key activists. If that's not sufficient, if you got good legal counsel, if you can mount the bail, if your organization is functioning properly, they go into things that are more extravagant, which is bringing about essentially false imprisonments, which is fabrication of evidence and so forth in order to obtain the conviction and sentencing of targeted activists. Geronimo Pratt is a key case of that. Dhruba bin Wahad is a key case of that. Rice and Poindexter, key cases of that. Leonard Peltier is a key case of that. You can keep on running them down. And interestingly enough, the more obviously innocent you are, the better they like it. So we keep trying to prove that, say, Leonard Peltier is innocent. Demonstrate that to people. They want that demonstrated, because it demonstrates the arbitrariness of their ability to visit consequences upon you of an unacceptable fashion, something that you will not to incur, want to incur as a consequence to yourself. That they can do it despite the fact that you're glaringly innocent, they can put you in prison for the rest of your life. That sends the requisite message. I guess the concomitant of that is the extent to which we could get people like Peltier out, Mumia off death row, and so forth. Sends a reverse message back to them. But the horsepower to get that done hasn't really been forthcoming, by and large. Finally, when all else fails, as it did with Fred Hampton, they kill you. They usually use surrogates to do it. But probably not always. Hampton's the classic case. I've already talked about Hampton. There was Mark Clark, who was also killed in the apartment with him. We should talk about that. But beyond that, you got something into, we'll bring it up to 1990. The guy who ran the cartoon campaign, United Slaves Black Panther Party, was a junior agent by the name of Richard Wallace Held. Richard Wallace Held is the son of Richard G. Held. Richard G. Held is the architect of COINTELPRO I quoted with regard to neutralization a while ago. This is a family business. Father taught the son. The son excelled from the day he hit the ground with the FBI. He was running the counterintelligence section, the Black Panther desk in Los Angeles, almost from the moment he got a field assignment with the FBI. Richard Wallace Held is the guy who put out the phony information on Jean Seberg that led to her miscarriage and ultimate suicide to neutralize Friends of the Panthers. Richard Held is the guy who fabricated the evidence to put Geronimo Pratt in prison for 27 years. Richard Held is the guy they brought in as a specialist on the Resmers investigation to bring about the false conviction of Leonard Peltier. Richard G. Held was ultimately rewarded at a very young age for an FBI agent with being named the special agent in charge of the San Francisco office of the FBI, in which capacity he presided over the car bombing of Daryl Cherney and Judy Berry. This is a professional occupation of neutralizing political activists. Now, it finally started to come out a bit on the Berry Cheney end of things, at which point he took an early retirement. Anybody out there got a Visa card? Come on, fess up. I know you're anarchists, but somebody out there has a Visa card. Yeah. Okay, you should feel very comforted because Dick Held took an early retirement as a SAC San Francisco. He was being groomed to be an associate director of the FBI by the time he was 55 years of age, which is astronomically young. That's successful. Okay, he's very much rewarded for the sorts of stuff I'm talking about. But since it started to come out, and that would look bad for the Bureau, they put him on the early retirement. He now ensures the fact that you can use your Visa card, okay, free from worry that frauds will take your number, okay, and use it for purposes of their own. He's head of security for the Visa Corporation these days. And that's one final thing I want to say in terms of technique before I tie this up, an overlong talk it was at that, and get into some filling of the holes, is that you can't just look to the roster of agent personnel. Dick Held has access to all the information on how you spend your money if you travel on Visa. And that includes your whereabouts, your locations, how you travel, when you travel, probably why you travel, your spending patterns. That's critical information, intelligence sense, and it's handed over directly to the FBI. It's fed right in on a list of target activists. And Hoover worked this out years and years and years ago. In 1924, when the Congress of the United States exercised its authority because the FBI had been aimed at them as it was during the Watergate era, okay, it was doing things to the good senators and representatives over there, and so they put a clamp on it, said, you can't engage in political investigative activity anymore. And he said, yeah, I agree, that's fine. I want to be out of the political repression business once and for all. You make me director, I will keep it that way. And then he began to take his top aides and assign them, basically set them up for jobs running industrial security operations for major manufacturing concerns. So they were doing labor espionage as private parties and feeding the information that the FBI itself technically wasn't gathering right into the filing system of the FBI. And they've been doing this now for 100 years. You look out there to Wackenhut. Wackenhut is an ex-FBI agent. You look at the roster of Pinkerton personnel, those are ex-FBI agents. You look at who's running security for Litton or ITT or any of these major corporations, these are FBI personnel. They get groomed, they get trained, they get their relationships, they get their basically set of affiliations set up, they get their priorities straight, then they're farmed out to the private sector to do the sorts of operational things in terms of surveillance, monitoring, and such that the FBI itself either doesn't have the manpower to do or for some reason doesn't want to be caught doing, but they get the information that way. So you got this nationwide net of political police out there, and it's been in existence for the better part of a century. We don't have to worry about what will happen if America becomes a police state. I've been hearing that all of my life. My God, if this keeps it up, we're going to be in a police state. Well, how many ups does it have to keep before we actually are in the police state? Is there some place you can look over your shoulder anywhere in the continental United States, and I don't care whether it's Paz, North Dakota, or DuPont Circle, where you're not likely to see a cop? Is there any place you can go that is not the ubiquitous presence of the overt symbology of the police, never mind the covert operatives, the plainclothes people that permeate society, the monitoring capacities and all the rest of that? Is there anything that you can do in your daily life that is not attached to a rule or regulation at this point? Tell me something. Anything that you can do. And I'm not asking, do you have the power to break the regulations, to break the law? You do, obviously, but that doesn't mean there's not a regulation or a law pertaining to it. And if you, as I do, define social freedom in terms of relative absence of regulation, you are in the least free society on the planet. Get used to it. The question is not what to do to prevent it. The question is what to do now that it's done.
I get the most freedom while I can.
Do you really?
Yes.
He thinks he gets the most freedom he can. Try setting your can out in the middle of the street and see what happens to you. There's regulations where you're allowed to do that, so even that's not free.
We just passed a regulation in Richmond, Virginia, introduced and then passed, deciding that you cannot have people sleep in your living room and kitchen. It's anti-immigration because it's clear that the immigrants get a house and 20 of them live in it, and they don't want them to do that. So they have passed the regulation, so all houses can only sleep in a bed.
Yeah. But I'll take other suggestions, what you think you're doing that you're free to do. Somebody said something about breathing air. I've got three letters that I'll say to you, and that's EPA.
Are you urging us to get out? I mean, what are you...
Get out of what? Where are you going to go?
So what... What,
well, what, like, do you think we should do?
Now that we're scared to death.
You're scared to death? Fear can be a good motivator. All right? I want you scared to death because that's a reality and a habitual practice in this society. And it doesn't matter whether you're Ozzie and Harriet living in suburbia or some paleo conservative out there in the fringes of the Freeman in Montana, or you fancy yourself a progressive, reality gets blinked. Because we have a politics of the comfort zone that has pertained by and large to the entire trajectory of opposition in this country. And we need to get out of it. You've got to understand what the reality is before you can conceive of effective means of countering it. So call things by their right names. Then you can call solutions by their right names and stop playing a game of let's pretend. And let's pretend is when we say, you know, we've got to curtail these, we've got to make these cosmetic changes, we've got to have community control over the police, we've got to make the FBI accountable to some discernible set of guidelines and so forth in order to prevent there being a police state. Hey, it's way late for that. Maybe that would have worked in, say, 1924.
Actually, it would have not worked in 1924. Back in 1924, it was against the law to tie your alligator to a fire hydrant in Detroit.
It was against the law in Detroit to tie your alligator to a fire hydrant.
It was also against the law in the 40s to leave peanuts in church while you were in Atlanta, Georgia.
If I'd known this, I'd have given up hope long ago. I thought at least I could park my alligator where I wanted, but I guess not. Yeah. Yeah, and this stuff will actually be enforced.
If so, it's against the law to walk around with an ice cream cone in your pocket.
Organizing, the global, domestic globalized repercussions for organizing. You know, we have an upcoming action in Quebec.
We're going to have problems crossing the border. We've got people infiltrating that we know about, but we don't know other people. What do you recommend we do? And what are you thinking about this?
I don't have an answer per se, clearly not one that's going to work for everybody. I don't even understand a lot of the politics of the groups that are involved in the room. You're going to have to use the information in order to forge a politic that works for you. The way that I've approached it and the way that I know some other people are approaching it seems one of the more viable strategies is the notion of affinity groups. The notion of dealing with people you have history with already, who you will be in proximity with, whose history you're going to continue to know, because people get changed. People do change, but people get changed as well. And if they're going to get changed and be a potential threat to me, I need to know about it. It's a kind of a paranoid, so it's a term that gets used, approach to things in a certain way. But on the other hand, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. When you're actually going to engage in an action of some sort, I mean, I sort of made that point to a guy yesterday who said, why don't we infiltrate the FBI and stuff? It's, you know, well, now he says, I guess since I said that, I probably can't do it. I said, now that you said it in a public place, probably nobody else can either. You know, you want to be thinking as if somebody was probably monitoring what you're saying. Okay, you make yourself a target for elimination if they take you seriously. You want to talk about things on the one hand, but not divulge what you're tangibly going to do. These kinds of things, which are precautionary, we got big mouths. I got a really big mouth myself, but I'm 55 years old. I'm probably not going to be engaged in the in-game move of this stuff anyway. So I'm trying to pass along what it is I picked up along the road to people who are younger than me, can put the information to work in ways that I was too dumb or uninformed to do in the first place. So there's that aspect of it as well. But I think the thing that has to be done primarily in terms of forging a viable politic is to dismantle this whole veneer of naivete. We carry a veneer, an image, an impression, a whatever of American innocence that is almost as nauseating as that held by the middle class. We can't believe they do this stuff. And every time they do, we think it's like inventing the wheel. Wow, they're infiltrating us. No shit. Yes.
At this point in the recording, a member of the audience speaks up. Meanwhile, the recorder needed to switch mini discs. After this gap, we return to the session in progress.
What is happening here?
It could have been something you said.
Okay, a bright side, and that's a good point, Chip. Give you something to work with. It's not that I'm really having that hard a time thinking up something that might be of a positive can. It's just that I'm laughing at how grim this stuff gets and how much got left out. But the upside of it is there is a certain continuity between the last generation of struggle and what it was that was done to us and what we learned as a result of that, and making available the information, the operational techniques and so forth, so that they can be understood before you're in the same situation that the Black Panther Party was, before you're in the same situation of internal confusion that the Students for a Democratic Society was, before they can do to you what they did to the Berrigans and so forth. You have the opportunity to use those precedents and those understandings for education to transform consciousness so that it won't resonate as being so plausible that a bunch of Catholic priests and nuns are going to run down into the tunnel system of Washington, D.C. and blow up the whole complex in order to take out Henry Kissinger. I mean, it's utterly preposterous, but it seemed plausible, and it seemed plausible because nobody could foresee it coming. Now you can. Now you can mount a cogent defense against these show trial things like what happened with the Panther 21. I mean, there was the aerosol can routine there too. These guys, they had them with a bunch of hairspray cans. Okay, and the hairspray cans were going to be used as the container devices for the making of a whole multiplicity of bombs using 1 ounce of black powder to take out the Bronx Botanical Gardens. Now there's a strategic target. Macy's department stores and half the police stations and the Bureau of the borough of Brooklyn and Bronx. Utterly implausible on its face, but no one was making the argument till after the fact, and they were all up in conspiracy charges. We have the capacity to now to respond in ways that were not possible in the 1960s, because frankly, in the 1960s, we didn't know a damn thing about the Palmer raids. We were making jokes about the CP, but we didn't really understand at the time. It was a coherent federal program. That was not known. COINTELPRO did not become known until 1971. Now we know. And on the basis of knowledge, we can collectively. Sometimes it's hard to tell the anarchists from the FBI personnel. And to be equipped in that way is to be able to avoid some of that catastrophe. Probably not all of it. There is not a given technique or set of principles that you can apply that will prevent any and all of this from being effective. But you can defend yourself much more adequately in understanding the historical precedent of it, the purposes of it, how it functions, and how it's likely to come at you than if you're getting caught blindsided the way we did. And a little self-criticism on that. The information was available on the Palmer raids and stuff. We were the new left. So we had very little time and energy available in our self-important existences to look at the experience of the old left. Do not repeat that error either.
Can you say that again?
We were the new left. Okay, all of us, everybody I was talking about in the 60s comes under the rubric of the new left. And the new left was so self-absorbed, self-indulgent, self-preoccupied, self-aggrandizing, we didn't have time and energy to look at what it was that had been the experience of the old left. And if we had, we could have avoided some of this stuff too. But we didn't know about the Palmer raids because we didn't bother with it. That was what was happening then with those guys, with those archaic notions. We got a whole new politic. Well, we didn't have a new politic. Ultimately, the new left ended up with a regurgitation of everything that was crystallized in the old left. But it took us about 10 years of being obliterated to arrive at that point. And we could have come out with a much more constructive outcome simply by learning what it was that had happened in the preceding generation, two generations. Now, you got that generation standing here talking to you. I'm not retired, but I'm coming out of that experience. And that's the reason I'm talking about this grim stuff. It's not that there's no hope. See, I'm still talking. There's a lot of dead people in my background. There's a lot of people in prison. Or previously in prison. There's been a lot of things that were derailed in my life. But I'm still here and I'm still at it, and you can draw something from that too. They have not ultimately been effective. They did not ultimately accomplish what they set out to do. Chip Berlay is another one. He's been at it since before I was, probably. There's other people who were speaking in here yesterday. We cannot tell you what to do. All we can do is tell you what was done. And you can draw the logical conclusions, or illogical if that's what you want to do, from those, but pay attention to them because it affects you. And that was implicit in that comment that was made yesterday about, hey, they're infiltrating us at these incredible levels. That doesn't have to be a hot news flash. In the experience of other organizations, other groups, other movements, in terms of dealing with that and what was done to them, gives you a predictive power that was absent from us. The stuff about the allegation that was made about the liberals turning in the more radical member of the environmental movement to the cops. There's a lesson to be learned from that, because they will draw people into that. Both sides. It's not like that's the first time that's ever happened. There's actually matters of principle to be considered in that connection, but there's also matters of objective and technique in the part of the state that need to be analyzed. And there's historical precedent and experience and conclusions to be drawn that can be brought to bear on that. But you have to actually look at it. You cannot reinvent the wheel every 15 minutes and hope to get any further along the line than we got. You'll end up in the same position that we did 20 years ago, and that is basically breaking traction, spinning your wheels, and going nowhere at all. Except maybe to jail. Except maybe into middle-class existence. Oh, better jail, huh? Yeah. I think we are beginning to run up on time for Chip's thing to begin. Has anybody got any burning issue that you want to try to get resolved in about 1 minute flat? There's been a question over here, I'm told, for a while. Okay. Who? Yeah. Yep.
That's Chip's question. As a former Panther, as one who recruited Grant Hamilton, the
Panther. Keep it down.
First of all, we see the hope in this room. There's always been repression in this country. Ask the African people. Since 1619, we don't do the precedence of repression in 1850. State militias, the colonial compacts, were in fact repressive instruments of slavery. Ask the indigenous people in this country who have faced repression from day one. We need to expand our concept beyond just the FBI. As a former Panther, I'm more concerned about the military intelligence agents who were in the room in the Panther Party killing us, especially the 113th Military Intelligence Group in Chicago, some of whose agents perhaps still exist today within this movement. There's a continuity of the movement, there's a continuity of the repression. We need to understand that we are the hope. To walk into this room and see a new generation of white youth in the streets, because we remember some of the old whites, youth movement in the 60s, who we don't know who they were and who they are. This is the hope, what is in this room. Because wherever there is oppression, there will be resistance. People will always fight for what they are for and what they are against. But we do need to do some update on this COINTELPRO analysis. We'll suggest, Ward, that you reread the COINTELPRO memo of August 67 and February and March 4 of 68. While you are perhaps correct that no acronym, COINTELPRO, SCLC, COINTELPRO, Martin Luther King, they were in fact counterintelligence operations.
Yeah, I thought I made that clear, Bob.
And RAM were taken out before Huey Newton.
Yeah.
We were taken out before Huey Newton and written out of history. Even the history of the white left in this country perpetuates tonight certain disinformation, which is in fact an instrument of oppression. We thank you for the work that you have done, at least for keeping this issue alive. But we need to give it some serious consideration and to correct some of the factual inaccuracies and errors that we have even made in this country. But the hope is in the truth.
Let me amplify what was just said. I thought I'd made that clear, but perhaps it needs to be clearer. And I think I didn't really put the cap on the point. What was done to SNCC, what was done to SCLC, actually what was done to RAM as well, were not captioned COINTELPRO. They were, when you look at the documents, however, utilizing all of the counterintelligence techniques that would come under a COINTELPRO. So you simply cannot go by the use of a given acronym to appreciate the underlying reality. You've got to look at what was done. The techniques, and this is what we'll get into in the next session, I would assume, have been continued despite the fact they've abandoned the acronym altogether. COINTELPRO is alive and well. COINTELPRO hit organizations that were not captioned in their file indexes as being COINTELPROs with exactly the same kinds of techniques that were visited upon those organizations that were pressed within the formal rubric of COINTELPRO. Even when they did the Church Committee in 75 and they were talking about the termination date of COINTELPRO, they made reference, even there the senators did, that it appeared that counterintelligence operations were ongoing under other titles. So it's the techniques, it's its goals, and it's the objectives of the operation which are at issue, not its name. Not its name. So I thank you for bringing that out in a more forceful way, because I kind of let that one get blurry. Yeah.
I just want to say that our hope and our success and how we're going to be successful is in our solidarity, because like we saw in Philadelphia, they put out a warrant saying that that the people who were arrested in at the Philadelphia convention last summer were, you know, somehow connected with the former Soviet Union, all kinds of ridiculous stuff. But we stuck together, you know, and stood that out, and the felony charges were dropped. Because we stood behind our people and arrested. Well, most of the felony charges were dropped.
A bunch of them were. Yeah.
And so, but if we keep working on that, work together, and don't leave behind the people who do get arrested, don't leave behind, you know, the people who are being targeted, but stand behind them, that's how we're going to succeed.
Yeah. That's a good point. You don't back off. They'll try to bluff you into putting yourself in a position of admitting that things that are fabricated are wrong. That you admit to it. And thereby confirm what was said. Yeah.
This has been a recording of Ward Churchill giving A History of Counterintelligence. He spoke at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 28, 2001.